Monday to Friday, 2:30 to 4, it is The Blitz here on AM 1450 KATE. Mitch Widmeyer here with you. We go to the phone lines. He comes on every week. We always appreciate his presence and his time. Jim Suhan of the Star Tribune, our guest this afternoon, has his own podcast network. You can find it at mnspn.com. This, as always, is brought to you by Greenlee Golf Course. Thank you, as always, Jim. We'll start with the Wolves, make our way to the Twins. The Vikings will bop around all over the place today, but I thought we'd start with Tom Thibodeau's club. I made the case after the loss in Memphis earlier this week that they looked on edge. Like, the players kind of looked like they were a little bit leery of what was going on. Outside of the Andrew Wiggins buzzer beater in Oklahoma City this year, I don't think this team has really shown signs that they're enjoying the season. Have you noticed that at all as well?
Yeah, the body language is very interesting. I would even say Carl Anthony Towns' facial expressions, his body language, the fact that Butler is very willing to call out this team, which is good that he's willing to do it. It's bad that he has to do it so often. The fact that Wiggins still seems to float. There are concerns here. And, the record, maybe they're one or two games off what they should be, but the record isn't bad. The record puts them on pace to be a good, solid playoff team, which is what everybody kind of wanted this year. It's style, it's situational play, it's body language, it's atmosphere. Just doesn't feel like a team yet. And, sometimes in the NBA, teams never end up becoming teams. It's not an automatic that it'll happen just over time.
I had someone tell me yesterday when I brought that up, or Monday, whenever it was, they said something to the tune of like, who cares about having fun? They should be winning. That should be the focus. To which I said, winning is fun. And in sports, winning can cure and cover up a whole heck of a lot. Like, the Knicks are 12-12 this year, and I've watched, I'd say, about three-fourths of their games as a Knicks fan, and I'm biased, but I can tell that team is enjoying the season that they are having, and they are sitting right at 500. They're not blowing anyone out of the water. They're not taking the league by storm, but you can tell they're having fun and they're enjoying the process as it works along. Could part of it, when I thought about it from that perspective, could part of it be expectations, Jim, that the Wolves internally and externally had some lofty expectations for this year that could add to this?
Maybe, but I don't think so. I mean, Butler's been under pressure before. Thibodeau's been under pressure before. Towns and Wiggins are facing big pressure as top picks who are expected to lead a franchise. I mean, all these people have dealt with pressure in different ways at different times of their careers, and nobody was picking them to win the NBA championship or win the Western Conference championship. People just thought they had a chance to be a good team, and, that's not a burdensome expectation. I think it's more about dynamics. I don't think Towns and Tibbs are exactly on the same page. I don't think Wiggins always gives his full effort. Now you have people in that locker room who are willing to call them out when they don't. You still have Towns and Wiggins are still at a stage of their career where they probably care more about offensive stats than anything else, and that's kind of natural for most young players. They want to establish themselves first. And then you have veterans like, Butler and Gibson who feel like they should be policemen in that locker room and who really care more about winning than anything else. It's not. I don't want to go so far as to say it's bad. It's just a little worrisome at this point.
The product was much better last night, and I know it was a close game against a lowly Clippers club, but they did have Danilo Gallinari back, and the Wolves completely shut him down. I think he was 3 of 12 or 2 of 13, something like that, his first game back in about a month. And I thought on the flip side of the court, offensively, that the Wolves, it was probably the most in sync and the most in rhythm I've seen them in quite some time. Did you have some similar takeaways watching last night?
You and I usually agree on stuff. I'm going to disagree this time around. I do think early on, I think they built the lead with really good ball movement, really good passing, and that was encouraging to see. I thought Gallinari just looked rusty. His shot is flat. He just doesn't look like himself. I just think he's going to take a while to get his skills back. So I didn't see the Wolves taking him out as so much as him just not being quite ready. And I thought that after they got themselves the lead with really crisp offensive play, they let it get away with really sloppy offensive play, with tons of turnovers, and with really bad defense. I mean, they let people go to the rim pretty much anytime they wanted. They let people run on them. They did not look connected defensively, and they let Clippers actually get it to, about a six-point game late before they made a couple plays to hold it off. To me, that that was one of those games on the schedule where if you're and you're they're playing eight guys right now with Bielitsa hurt and with Shabazz not playing, they're playing eight guys. And big picture, I think that's the night when you got to hold your 20-point lead and be able to rest your starters in the fourth quarter rather than having everybody out on the court for 40 minutes again.
You bring up an interesting point because Jimmy Butler said after the game he was talking to Marnie Gellner on Fox Sports North, and he said, I forget what it was, I'm going to paraphrase slightly, but he said, Tibbs has got to watch me play in like 40 minutes a night. Do you think that was more tongue-in-cheek? Do you think he didn't seem like angry or upset by it, but do you think it was somewhat of an indirect message, like my minutes are kind of getting out of control here a little bit? He's used to it, though. When he was in Chicago, he kind of played the same amount of time with Tibbs many years.
Well, Butler doesn't police what he has to say. He's pretty blunt, and I think it was both a humorous jab at Tibbs, but like a lot of humor, it contains truth. I you know, he's not going to go storming into Tibbs' office and scream at him, but I wouldn't be surprised if Butler said, hey, you know, maybe long term it's better if I'm playing 35 instead of 40. And I do think this is another gray area. I don't know that it's necessarily terrible to play good young athletes 35 or 40 minutes instead of 30 to 32 minutes. I don't know that those few extra minutes really damage your team or damage the players. I do think that it's bad when you have to play people that many minutes because you don't have enough help off the bench. And I think that's the aspect that needs to be fixed. Obviously, they need to get Bielitsa healthy. To me, they have to get Shabazz going. Whether this is a punishment or a message or whatever it is, benching him, they kind of need him. And they don't need him to win 42 games and make the playoffs, but they need him if they're going to be better than that, I think. And it's whether it's pushing him in practice, whatever, Tibbs has got to find a way to get him going because without him, they lack scoring off the bench and they lack quality minutes.
How are you choosing to view the Wolves at this point? Is it, wow, they're 15-11 and they still haven't fully clicked or figured it out? Or is it that exact same sentence but a different tone? Is it, wow, they're 15-11 and they still haven't fully clicked or figured it out?
I think it's all of the above. The record is fine. The place in the standings is fine. They have a chance to place to win some games here at home, although their last homestand was a little bit disappointing. But to me, it's still more about, you know, if you look, they're good enough just playing the way they are to make the playoffs and maybe even give somebody a little bit of trouble in the first round. But that's not the goal. You know, you don't have Towns, Wiggins, Butler, Gibson, Crawford, Tibbs, and, you know, you don't have these people to settle for that. And so the question is, how are they going to move toward being a championship caliber club? And yeah, to be championship caliber, the defense is going to have to be a lot better. Towns is going to have to be much more active defensively and engaged on a nightly basis. He has a chance to be superstar great, and he's not quite there yet. Wiggins needs to bring it every night. They got to find more quality bench minutes, and whatever it is going on with Tibbs and Towns or Tibbs and the young players has to move in a positive direction.
Find his work in the Star Tribune. Podcast Network can be located at MNSPN.com. Jim Suhan, our guest this afternoon, always enjoys time on the program. This, as always, is brought to you by Greenlee Golf Course. We'll transition. I saw your article in the Star Tribune a few days ago, one of yours on Shohei Ohtani. And first off, you called your shot saying, this was a few days ago, you said the Twins could trade some of their international bonus money for a prospect. They did that. They did it twice last night with both the Angels and the Mariners. When you really dive into it, how savvy of a move was that by the Twins' brain trust?
I guess part savvy, part kind of obvious. I mean, you know, they wanted to get in on Ohtani. As soon as they knew they weren't in on Ohtani, they knew that they had this bonus money. I wrote about it. The first person who mentioned the possibility to me was Roy Smalley on our baseball podcast on my network. He said, hey, you know, you're not going to get Ohtani, so trade this. I guess I would have thought it more ideal if they had been able to package their money and get one really good player or good prospect. Instead, they spent $1 million each on a couple of guys who were, you know, fifth and third round draft picks. They have talent. They haven't figured out offensively yet, but they, you know, it does probably deepen the farm system. You know, it's funny. I started covering Twins in 1993 as a beat writer, and I've known their general managers, their managers, their key players, their behind the scene personnel, you know, better than I've known anybody else in town. I've covered the Vikings for a long time too, and partly as a beat writer. But the NFL it's harder to get close to. So even though I know people there, it's not a face to face thing as much as baseball is. And I've always had a sense of what they're where they're going, what they're doing, what's going on behind the scenes. And frankly, with these, you know, the new front office, they don't communicate much. They aren't very available. They don't answer many phone calls. They don't give many press conferences. To me, it's a complete mystery how they're going to operate this winter. I really don't have a feel for it.
All right, let's go down that path then, because one thing that has me a bit giddy is I'm reading stories, Jim, about Jake Arrieta and potential suitors, Yu Darvish, same thing, some of these other highly touted free agent pitchers. And just about every outlet that I go to that I'm reading from or hearing people voice their thoughts and opinions on a national scale about some of these free agent pitchers, they mention the Twins as at least an option for Arrieta, for Yu Darvish, for some of these other guys. And my question is, when's the last time you remember a Twins front office that has shown signs of this aggressiveness in the offseason, that at least it appears they might go and be aggressive?
Well, Terry Ryan was incredibly aggressive, especially during from 98 to about 2007. He was incredibly aggressive in terms of traits, and he was really good at it. He didn't believe in building through free agency, and he didn't have the funds to do it very aggressively if he had chosen to go that direction. So he kind of he was a bottom feeder when it came to free agents, partly because of the poll ads, and he really worked aggressively to build his team and his farm system through trades, and it worked out very well for him. The interesting thing here, and this is why I brought up kind of the mystery of this front office, is it's really easy to get yourself on the interested list. It's a whole another quantum leap to finish in the top two or three, and then it's another quantum leap from there to actually outbid every other team in baseball for a prize free agent. Because let's not ever forget what free agency is. Free agency is not a proper valuation of a player. Free agency is a grotesque overspending for that player. You ain't spending the median amount on that player that everybody thinks he's worth. You're spending more than anybody else thinks he's worth. So free agency is exciting for people to talk about, but it's also very dangerous.
On a league-wide note, how wild do you envision this offseason being? You've got really good free agent pitchers who will draw big contracts, the National League MVP potentially being traded, and you've got this aforementioned Shohei Ohtani, a 23-year-old Japanese phenom who's being called the Babe Ruth of Japan coming over. Is this one of the more, it could be one of the more entertaining free agencies off seasons in recent years?
It could be the most dramatic ever when you combine Ohtani, a guy who could look different than any player since Babe Ruth. I'm saying he's good as Babe Ruth, but you know, a guy who could actually play positionally and be a pitcher at the same time and be really and have, you know, otherworldly skills at both positions. That doesn't happen. Trading the National League MVP as he's holding the trophy doesn't happen. You have Darvish and Arrieta. You have relief pitchers everywhere. I think you're going to see some trades. And I think it's all a function of, I think Major League Baseball is in really good shape. I think that teams have money to spend. They have great television contracts. Everybody has realized with, you know, the Cubs and the Astros winning the World Series the last couple of years that anybody can do it if you manage yourself right and you use your draft picks right. It just feels like a wide open, a golden era almost of baseball moves to me.
We always love having him on the program. Jim Suhan, kind enough to take time out of his day this afternoon to hop on the Blitz. Find his work in the Star Tribune podcast network at MNSPN.com. This segment brought to you by Greenlee Golf Course. We'll finish up with the Vikings. Was last Sunday in Atlanta against the Falcons, was that the most impressive win of the season for Mike Zimmer's squad? I think you could make a case for the L.A. Rams game as well, but I don't know how good the Falcons are, but I do know, Jim, that they had won three straight before they welcomed in the Vikings, that offense appeared to have figured it out. They were hosting Minnesota, they're the defending NFC champion, and the Vikings limited them to 9 points and completely wiped out that offense and the momentum they brought into the game.
I think that was the most impressive victory. The Rams, we still don't know how good Rams, we know the Rams are good, we don't know how good, and the Vikings have a great home field advantage, and they took full advantage of it in that game. And I thought they were the better team. The Falcons, you could have argued going into the game that over the last month, the Falcons had been even more impressive than the Vikings. Julio was hot. Matt Ryan was hot. They had gotten the running game going. They got Devontae Freeman back. They're playing at home. They're on a streak. The game is probably even more important to the Falcons than the Vikings. And the Vikings just kind of strangled. I mean, it was very impressive. And it was great. You know, that was my column off the game. It was great situational football. It was great fitting together of the offense and the defense, where they played field position. They capitalized in the red zone. They kept the Falcons out of the end zone. It was just really impressive coaching. It was really impressive situational play, whether it was Keenum or the running backs, the offensive line, Pat Shurmur, the defense. I came away feeling more impressed immediately after that game than any other game this year.
Since you referenced home field advantage and how it plays into the Vikings' favor, of course, when they're at U.S. Bank Stadium, Mike Zimmer was asked about the current standings on Monday and how the Vikings have the one seed as of right now. They have the tiebreaker over Philly. He said something to the tune of, he doesn't really care. It's for the media to worry about. The team's focus, his focus, is on Carolina. Obviously, they would take the one seed if offered, but how much do you think it will matter to this team? I feel like for the Vikings, they've been just as good on the road as they've been at home so far this year, but the playoffs is a different beast. How much do you think it matters for this team as it's currently assembled if they could host Philadelphia instead of going to Philly, if they could host New Orleans again instead of having to go there? Will it matter that much for this team?
I think it matters, and it depends on the opponent. I think there's a massive difference in playing at Philadelphia outdoors against a really good team with a crazy fan base as opposed to playing them here. I think that's a huge difference. Saints, huge difference playing in New Orleans versus playing here. I almost guarantee you that if the Vikings had played the 2009 NFC Championship game against the Saints in Minnesota instead of New Orleans, they would have probably won by 15, 20 points. They were a better team. Part of the reason the Saints were able to win that game was the atmosphere and the Vikings kind of tensing up a little bit. So I think those, and you know, Seattle's not really on the horizon, but let's say something crazy happened. Playing at Seattle and playing Seattle here, huge difference. Falcons, I don't think they have a great home field advantage. It's just not that passionate a fan base. It's not that loud a place. But some of the, and Carolina, I think, big difference there and here. I think the Vikings can win in Carolina. They won there, I think, last year early. But this team just isn't as good on grass. It just traditionally has not been. So I think home field advantage in this case is a big deal.
We'll wrap it up on this. You mentioned the Panthers. The Vikings are in Carolina taking on Cam Newton and company this week. How do you like the Vikings' chances against Carolina, and how fearful for Cam Newton are you knowing that his left tackle, Matt Khalil, will probably be going up against Everson Griffin this weekend?
Yeah, and Khalil's among the most penalized offensive linemen in the game this year. I watched his play against the Saints, and you know, Cam Jordan beat him up pretty good. That's a very good player he was going against. I think the Vikings are the better team. The question is, as you look at the Vikings' schedule, do you really see them, you know, with all of their injury limitations, do you really see this team ending up 14-2? And if you don't, then where are they going to lose? So it's like, if you want to just talk about this game, I think the Vikings are probably the better team, and that gives them a chance to win even on the road. If you look at the big picture, man, it's almost like I do admit that I have tended to doubt them on a week-to-week basis against better opponents, saying, well, of course they're going to lose eventually, but if they beat Carolina, maybe they're not going to lose eventually.
Find his work, Star Tribune Podcast Network, MNSPN.com. Jim, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Mitch. Appreciate it.
The long-awaited Jim Mora playoff segment coming up next.